Great. So thanks for having me here at Perimeter. It's been really fun to visit for the past few days. I'm going to be talking about recent work that we've done on the bulk edge correspondence for chiral, abelian, quantum Hall states. So this is work done at UCSB and Microsoft Station Q in collaboration with Meng Cheng, Mike Mulligan, Chetan Nayak, Eugenio Plama Diala, and John Yard. So quantum Hall states are strongly correlated systems of electrons that have interesting topological properties. So as we all kind of know, the bulk is gapped, and on the edge, there's gapless excitations. And so the question that we are trying to answer is, when can a bulk phase have multiple corresponding edge phases? And the answer that we'll see is pretty much most of the time. And this includes a lot of experimentally relevant, kind of relevant examples. Integer quantum Hall states at integer fillings greater than or equal to 8, and some of the fractional quantum Hall states that I've listed here. So, in order to talk about the correspondence between bulk phases and edge phases, we first need to define what we mean by a bulk quantum Hall state. So, a bulk quantum Hall state is defined by many universal and non-universal quantities. So, we're mostly interested in these universal quantities that I've listed, which are the quantized conductance. Which you can see as the plateaus in these really nice Hall traces, and also a series of a set of quasiparticle species and their statistics. That's what we're going to say defines a bulk quantum Hall phase. There's also non-universal features that people can measure and are interested in, which is measuring the bulk gap, measuring the width of plateaus, but that's not the type of stuff that we're going to be concerned with right now. So that's our understanding of what a bulk state is. So then we want to ask, well, what defines an edge state? And maybe before asking this, we can say, well, why do we even expect something interesting to happen at the edge? So if you recall, electrons in a magnetic field give us Landau levels. But if we put this system on a place that has a boundary, then instead of having flat Landau levels, the Landau levels will curve up at the edges. So if we put the chemical potential between two Landau levels, which is always what we'll be considering, it now will intersect the Landau levels at the edges of the system. And at each of these intersections is where we get gapless excitations. So we can see immediately a few features of these gapless excitations. They always reside near the edge of the system. There's exactly one excitation for each filled Landau level. They have a linear dispersion relation to leading order, and they're chiral. So if we want to write down a Lagrangian for the edge, we need to make sure that it meets all these characteristics that we can just see from this simple picture. So in order to write down a Lagrangian for the edge that has all these characteristics, the first thing that we're going to do is bosonize the fermions. And so the typical bosonization procedure is that we write psi dagger equals e to the I phi. And using this, the electron density is like dx phi. And then we can write down a simple chiral boson Lagrangian where it's easy to see that it meets all the, has all the qualities that we want it to have. So it resides near the edge. That's a feature of being 1D. We can have it reside wherever we want. There's exactly one species per filled Landau level. So this sum over I, this index I, indicates all of the edge species that we have. There's a linear dispersion relation, and as long as all of these Vs are positive, the edge is chiral. So you might ask, well, we can also complicate this by adding density-density interactions. So this original Lagrangian is diagonal in the fields I, but actually we could write terms which are like dx phi I, dx phi j, with some matrix that parameterizes them, but we can always rediagonalize this and get back to our original diagonal chiral boson Lagrangian. So this is a simple picture that describes integer quantum Hall states. And these are the types of Lagrangians that I'm going to be using throughout the talk, except more general. So the first way that we can generalize them, well, okay, so before we generalize them, we can say that the integer quantum Hall state, the edges look like Fermi liquid. So if we look at the correlation functions, like expectation values of psi dagger psi, which in our bosonized language look like e to the I phi, e to the minus I phi, the correlations go like 1 over x minus t. And the allowed operators in these theories are just electron operators, e to the I n phi, where these n's are all integers. So these are just different combinations of electrons in the different edge modes. So one way to generalize this is by considering Laughlin states. So Lhasa states have very similar Lagrangian, but they have a number out in front here, which is an odd integer m. And so it looks like having an overall prefactor in front isn't going to change your physics at all. You could just absorb it into the definition of phi. But actually, because of the way that we've compactified phi, we can't absorb this integer n without changing the allowed quasiparticles. So if we maintain the same allowed set of quasiparticles, which is e to the I times integer multiples of phi, then we see that this Lagrangian actually gives us different physics. So some of the allowed operators are like e to the I m phi. So this would be the electron operator. We can see this by commuting it with the electron density. But now the operator e to the I phi with a single phi here is a quasiparticle operator, and it carries fractional charge. And we can calculate correlators of both the electron operator and this quasiparticle operator. And we see that now the correlators for the electron operator, instead of looking like a Fermi liquid, have this exponent m, and the correlators for the quasiparticle operators have an exponent 1 over m. This is all, and so this is described by Luttinger liquid theory. So to completely generalize this, we can consider a quantum Hall edge that has many different fields, interactions between all of these fields, and the most general Lagrangian that we can write down has three different terms. So the first term is what's called the K matrix, and this is going to be kind of the seminal part of all of the work that we're doing. So the K-matrix contains all of the universal physics, and I'll come back to what this means. The V-matrix parameterizes velocities and interactions. So this is all non-universal stuff, and it's going to depend on the disorder strength, the shape of the confining potential, so things that are microscopic details. And then the third term is coupling to the electromagnetic field, and so this is what we call a T-vector, and it carries the charge of each edge mode. So the K-matrix has all of the universal physics. So what do I mean by that? It tells us the filling fraction. We can find the filling fraction by taking T, K inverse T. We can find the ground state degeneracy by taking the determinant of the K-matrix. And we can find the chiral central charge, which tells us the number of right moving modes, say, by taking the difference in the number of positive eigenvalues and negative eigenvalues of the K-matrix. So when we're talking about chiral quantum Hall states, that means that the eigenvalues of the K-matrix all have the same sign. And the K-matrix also gives us quasiparticle charge and statistics. So all of the quasiparticles are represented by an integer vector m, which is the coefficients of each of the fields in this exponent. And so for a particular quasiparticle, we find its charge by taking m k inverse t. And we can also find the statistics when a quasiparticle labeled by m and a quasiparticle labeled by m prime circle each other. And that's a phase m k inverse m prime. And this is what's called the S matrix. Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure.
Can you remind me how do you show this exponential correlators between the two? One is m, the other is 1 over m?
Oh, yeah. So you can find this just by...
It's right.
Oh, the exponent is definitely right. You can find this by just using the chiral boson correlator. So correlator of phi phi is like log, is like a log, and the m will either be in the, I guess it goes like 1 over m. So this correlator is just, you can write the correlator of e to the I phi, e to the minus I phi, like the exponential of the phi phi correlator. And the phi phi correlator goes like 1 over m times log of x. And so that's how you get this bottom line. And then the top line just has m squared times the phi phi correlator in the exponent. So you get m squared times 1 over m, and that's what gives you the m. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, so when we... oh, yeah, please.
Can you do it? Like, I don't have charge. Mm-hmm. Is it just a sign?
Oh, yeah, it's just meant to be a sign. So in other words, you can add right and left moving modes, and that doesn't change your bulk physics. The important part is kind of net number moving in one direction.
Right, but I thought the kind of central charge would be some number.
No, I'm sorry. It's not the, it's the difference. I'm sorry. That was meant to be signature. Right. I'm sorry. It's not the sign. It's the, yeah, it's not the pair, nor is it the sign. It's something in between, which is the number of positives minus the number of negatives. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, that's confusing. That's meant to be signature. Okay, so great. So from the K-matrix, we can see all these universal features, and these are the exact features that define the bulk phase. So the point is, if we're given an edge Lagrangian, which has a K-matrix and a T-vector, we get all the information that we need to talk to define the bulk. And so there's definitely a one-way relationship where if you know the edge physics of your system, you can figure out the bulk physics of your system. And then, so here's some examples. So for an integer quantum Hall state, just to put things in context, the filling fraction is just an integer number, and the K-matrix is just an identity matrix. For a Laughlin state, like I showed, the filling fraction is 1 over M, and the K-matrix is just a 1 by 1 matrix. You could consider a bilayer system. For a bilayer system, the K-matrix will be block diagonal. And you can also consider hierarchy states. These are just examples. There's obviously many types of K-matrices. And for these hierarchy states, you usually have ones on the off diagonal. So these are examples to hopefully put some of this into context. So one question that we need to know is, can two different K-matrices describe the same edge physics? So you have two different edge Lagrangians, and you want to know, are they actually describing all the same stuff? And the way that you figure this out is if you have two different K matrices and they're related by the similarity transform. So we'll always call this type of matrix W, and W is an integer matrix with determinant 1. And that combination means that this that if you transform the variables according to this matrix W, you preserve exactly all the boundary conditions for the fields, which means that you have the exact same set of quasiparticles. So if you have two different K matrices and they're relatable by this similarity transform, and then the T vectors are also relatable, what this tells us is that we can write a change of variables from phi goes to phi tilde, and the edge Lagrangian will look different because K1 will go to K2 and T1 will go to T2, but actually, this is just a trivial change of variables. All the quasiparticles are the same. You can check that the filling fraction is the same. The statistics are the same. So we don't want to consider these two K-matrices different to describe different physics. They describe all the same physics. And so this W transformation defines an equivalence class of K-matrices.
What's the interpretation of the T part of
this? Oh, so the T tells you the charge. So it's kind of the relationship between T and K together, but usually people just have the T vector just be like 1 and all zeros, or maybe all ones, and that just, it's the strength of the coupling between the electromagnetic field and the quasiparticles. Okay, so we have equivalence classes of K matrices, but then you might ask, well, finding a similarity transform is pretty difficult. So is there kind of a quicker way to see that whether two different K matrices are in the same equivalence class? And one way is to look at their scaling dimensions. So you can compute the scaling dimensions of operators in the way that I was saying. And it turns out that for the chiral theories that we're considering, the scaling dimension of a quasiparticle operator, either IM phi, comes completely from the K matrix. And it's just the statistics divided by 2. So if you have two different theories, generically, their scaling dimensions are going to differ. And so if you have two different K matrices and you want to know whether they describe the same physics or not, you can compare their scaling dimensions. And if they have different scaling dimensions, then you can immediately rule them out for describing the same physics. If they have all the same scaling dimensions, then maybe you need to do a little bit more work. And then the other point is that when K is non-chiral, then the scaling dimensions will depend on the V matrix. So it's actually a pretty special thing for chiral edge states that the scaling dimension is just given by this really simple form, which you can read off when you have a quasiparticle. So we can use these scaling dimensions to talk about different experiments that will distinguish between edge phases. So if you have different edge phases and you're saying that they give you different physics, you want to be able to have experiments that are going to detect these physics. So I'm going to talk about two different experiments that I'll come back to as I give some examples later. But the first experiment is if you have tunneling across a quantum point contact. So you have a Hall bar, and maybe you'll pinch it in, kind of like I've drawn here. So so now quasi-particles are allowed to tunnel from one edge to the other. And when you have this situation, you can write down a tunneling Lagrangian. And the tunneling Lagrangian will be a sum over all possible tunneling terms. So it'll be a sum over many different types of quasi-particles where you'll create one on the right and annihilate one on the left. But one of these terms is probably going to be the most relevant term. And so if we were to calculate current across this junction, we expect that the current is going to be dominated by the most relevant term. And if this is the case, then we can say that the current takes this simple scaling relation. I is proportional to V to this exponent. And this exponent here is going to be the smallest value of mk inverse m that a quasiparticle can take. So you can see that if two different theories have two different scaling dimensions, two different sets of scaling dimensions, then this IV curve will have different scaling. And so this is an experiment that can physically distinguish between different edge theories. And a similar thing that we can do, yeah, please.
Mm-hmm. A particular edge phase, you expect many terms.
So this is kind of like saying for one third state, you could tunnel one third quasi-particles, you could tunnel whole electrons, so you could tunnel any number of things, but usually you expect that the tunneling will be dominated by one of these. I mean, you could tunnel charge 2e pairs. That's a pretty unlikely thing to happen. One, it's physically unlikely, and also it's highly irrelevant.
So maybe depending on the number of density of quasi-particles you expect in the system.
So I think you kind of expect, this is just talking about like the most relevant term in the RG sense. So all the terms will have some exponent, but this is the one that will scale up to be the largest. And then there's also physical reasons, like I said, like some type of weird composite of quasi-particles you would think is really unlikely, because it's highly unlikely that everything will clump together and tunnel at one point, since tunneling is perturbative. And so the second experiment is really similar to this. It's tunneling in from a metallic lead. And so the difference between these, so this is meant to be the Hall bar, and this is a metallic lead. Now we can only tunnel electrons, since this is some metallic thing. It's not in a quantum Hall state. So similarly, if you're talking about tunneling from a lead, there's going to be a bunch of different terms which will tunnel one electron, tunnel two electrons, tunnel many electrons. But usually, the one electron tunneling operator is probably the most relevant. So it'll be like a creation operator in the lead and some type of quasiparticle annihilation operator on the edge. And the condition is that this quasiparticle better have charge one in order to have charge conservation. So if this is the most relevant term, then it will dominate the tunneling current between the lead and the quantum Hall edge. But we'll see that there's some cases where your edge doesn't have a single electron quasiparticle. It only has a charge 2e quasiparticle. And so then you can't write this type of term, but you can write down a different term, which will be like psi d psi. And this will be like a charge 2e quasiparticle. And this will have different scaling. And so whatever the most relevant term is that your edge theory allows, it'll have scaling, which is given by mk inverse m plus n squared. And so again, if you have two different edge theories, they'll generically have two different exponents here. And so this is just another experiment that we can do that will distinguish between the two edge phases.
Can people already measure these exponents? Like if you do an
So there's a large history of this. And so the experiments are definitely done and the exponents are measured, but not very well, right? So in some examples, when there's a big difference between these exponents, like a positive and a negative one, I think that would be something that people could observe. But like a difference between like one third and one quarter is certainly not really going to be observed clearly. But that's a hope for cleaner systems at lower temperatures, you know, in principle.
So the problem is disorder, or?
Well, I think actually the problem is that a quantum point contact isn't really a point contact, so there's some shape. This will be a factor. There's subleading terms, so we're talking about the most relevant term. Sometimes the next relevant term might be important, you know, for other reasons. Relevance isn't everything if you have a really large coefficient. And so this is, I think the problem is just that this is a bit too simple of a picture.
Yeah, there's another reason that the edge is not sharp enough. Usually in a semiconductor, the edge region is like 1,000 angstrom. The magnetic lens is 100 angstrom. So the edge region more like a mechanic compressible strike.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really very sharp edge.
Yeah.
And so we don't know how to confine edge very sharply within 100 angstrom.
Mm-hmm.
The, all the gate confinement is at scale 1000 angstrom.
Yes. And the same thing about the quantum point
contact.
It's not a point contact. It's more like probably a dull hill. So this is in principle a physical experiment. Okay, so this is kind of meant to be an overview of the notation that I'll be using, kind of quantum Hall background. And so now I'll get into kind of the newer stuff, which is phase transitions that we think will happen on the edge. And so the way that we get phase transitions is by interacting with modes that are gapped. And so I drew this picture before of Lando levels, which are curving up at the edge of the system. So here I kind of included this weird feature because one possibility, as Xiaogang just said, is that the edges they're not really that steep. They're actually kind of shallow. They can be kind of bumpy. And so there's not a reason why these Lando levels have to go straight up. They can have all sorts of bumps and wiggles, and there'll be all sorts of energy gaps which will characterize these. And so one possibility is that you have some kind of gap like this, and it's actually not very big, and maybe you can have interactions between gapped excitations and your gapless excitations. Or you could even imagine an edge that maybe dips back down, and so the chemical potential might intersect the Lando level in multiple places. And so if your edge kind of has this dipping back down shape, the chemical potential will intersect it in two more places, and that will give you two more gapless modes. And so another way to think about this is if you have your quantum Hall system, it has some edge modes, and if you put next to your quantum Hall system a strip of nu equals one fluid, nu equals one has one backwards and one forward moving edge mode. And so this is the exact same picture as I'm drawing up here. You get two extra edge modes, a backwards and a forwards moving one. So these are different pictures of thinking about it. And what usually happens when you have a backwards moving edge mode like this is that there'll be backscattering, which we can think of as like backscattering across this nu equals one strip. And so that's what creates the gap in the first place. But it's possible that you can have really strong interactions between this now counterpropagating mode and your original edge. And these strong interactions might also gap the edge in a different way. And so the question that we're asking is, can interactions with these originally gapped edge modes change the phase of the edge? So it's kind of like you have two modes that gap each other out, but then if you had complete control of the edge potential and you were able to bring these edge modes down so that they're gapless and tune up some other types of interactions, could you then gap these modes out in a different way so that you had a different edge phase? So the formalism for thinking about this is using the K matrices that I was talking about before. So, oh yeah, please. Right. So that's exactly it. So you're adding one positive and one negative.
So that has to stay constant as long as that's constant.
Right. Right. And we expect that what I just described, this procedure, it's clearly all happening on the edge. And so I guess the interesting part is that if you were to gap the edge in a different way, what you'd be seeing is an edge phase transition. We haven't changed anything in the bulk at all. So we can think about these using K matrices. This procedure of adding like a nu equals one strip means that you're taking your original K matrix, which is meant to be this block up here, and adding a block of sigma z, so plus one, minus one. And then we can ask what this thing is equivalent to. So we can check that this strip is topologically trivial because adding the plus one and minus one in the block diagonal, it doesn't change the filling fraction because you add and you subtract. It doesn't change the chiral central charge, as Anisha just asked. It doesn't change the determinant. It gives you a factor of minus one, but it won't change the ground state degeneracy. And it doesn't change your allowed quasiparticle spectrum because you're given you get these new quasiparticles, but they're just electrons, and you had electrons in your original system anyway. So this addition, as I said, physically we can think of this as not changing the bulk because we're only talking about bringing down gap modes on the edge, but also mathematically it doesn't change any of the things that we use to define the bulk. because it leaves everything invariant. Okay, so when we throw in these backwards moving modes, we can add backscattering terms. So the simplest backscattering term is just between this nu equals one edge. So if we pull down a strip of nu equals one and it's sufficiently skinny, there'll be scattering between the two edges and it will gap itself out. So that's kind of the original picture. When these gap each other out, then we're left with our original edge. But the other situation is that if there's strong interactions between this new backwards moving mode and the original modes, we can write down a different type of backscattering term. And so it will look like a quasi-particle tunneling term. And so now we want to know, well, when can this term open a gap? So there's a bunch of different scattering terms, and we want to know what the conditions are for this to gap out different modes. And so one condition is that this vector n must satisfy nk inverse t equals 0. So this means it's a scattering term that carries no charge. And this is obvious because we just want to consider scattering between different edge modes. We don't want to be injecting charge in. So that just says it's a neutral scattering term. And then the other condition is that it must have trivial statistics with itself, so it must commute with itself at different places. And this is because if we want to gap the edge, what that really means mathematically is we're writing down this cosine term in the Lagrangian, and we want to fix the value of this. So if this cosine term occurs at many different places in the system, and we want to fix its value, in order to fix it, you need to have a set of commuting operators. It's like fixing it to a classical eigenvalue, so we need it to commute with itself at different places. And so that's this condition here. And so this is one way of explaining why you can't have backscattering terms for a chiral edge, because for a chiral edge, like for example, if you take a K-matrix which is diagonal like this, you can never have the condition that nk inverse n equals 0. So you need to have these negative eigenvalues of the K-matrix in order to have this condition. So now if we look back at these two different cases, we can write down different types of tunneling terms that meet the conditions on the previous slide for gapping the edge. So for the skinny strip, the gapping term will just be, okay, so let me back up for a second. I'm going to look at an example now just to make this perfectly clear. So this example isn't particularly physical, but there's no reason to not think about it. So if we take the K matrix to be 1, 0, 0, 11, just because this is a 2 by 2 matrix, so it's easiest to think about, this is like 1 plus 1 over 11th fractional quantum Hall state. And so just to be concrete, now we have two edge modes, and we're adding two more. And so these are the two that we have, and these are the two that we're adding. And I drew this box here to represent a whole bunch of backscattering terms. And the backscattering terms enter the Lagrangian is cosine of phi 3 plus phi 4. And this is neutral, and it commutes with itself everywhere, and you can check this. But we could also write down a different type of backscattering term, which is cosine of phi 1 minus 11 phi 2 plus 2 phi 3 plus 4 phi 4. And this corresponds to a vector n, and it also meets all the conditions on the previous slide for gapping out edge modes. So either of these things could occur in principle. And if the first one occurs, we know what happens because it just gaps out this nu equals 1 strip. But we want to ask, well, what happens if the second cosine term is the most dominant tunneling term? And so the way to see this is by doing a strategic change of variables. So this is another one of these W matrices. So if we change from phi variables to phi prime variables for a strategic choice of W, which I didn't write down, then this kind of bizarre looking tunneling term actually takes a really simple form. And the K matrix is still block diagonal, but it has a different block. Instead of the K1 block that it had, it has this K2 block, which is 3114. So now these two tunneling terms are actually kind of on equal footing, just with a change of variables. So in the first theory, we know that we gap out the fields phi 3 and phi 4. But in the second theory, we'll gap out the fields phi 3 prime and phi 4 prime, which are complicated in the original fields, but easy in these new fields. So we can kind of summarize these two different cases as, in the first place, we gap out phi 3 and phi 4, so we're left with our original theory. But in the second case, we gap out phi 3 prime and phi 4 prime, and so we're left with the upper block of our new K matrix and the new variables, which is 3114. And the question that we want to ask is, well, are these different edges or are these the same edges? And you can see quickly that they're different by computing their minimum scaling dimension. So scaling dimension for chiral edge is completely determined by the K-matrix, and so we can find the minimum such scaling dimension. In the first case, it's 1 over 11. In the second case, it's 3 over 11. So these are two different edges that we just made by writing down a different type of backscattering term.
Can I ask a naive question? This is in my field, so this might be really dumb. But previously, the Lagrangian you wrote had a shift symmetry, I think, for the scalars phi. You could just add a constant and it didn't affect anything. But these potential terms don't have that property. So why is it, I guess I was thinking that shift symmetry was, meant that the overall phase was meaningless for this field. So how can it be that something depends on the absolute value of phi?
So,
this turns into energy, right? I mean, it's a term in the Lagrangian.
I don't think that the shift symmetry is actually meant to be something physical. So you have this, but I'm not sure why, but you have this condition, you know that you have a discrete set of loud quasi-particles. And that's the same thing as saying you have a compactification condition on these fields phi. And so certainly if you allow an arbitrary shift symmetry, then you're actually going to be changing the phases of all your quasi-particles. And I think that might not be a good thing. So maybe we shouldn't think of, so I'm not sure if that symmetry is actually a physical one.
That symmetry says that each branch, the charge is conserved, but actually only total charge is conserved. Do a lot of time to move from one branch to another branch. That is those cosine terms. Mm-hmm. So in this case, if you shift the phi 3 phi 4 opposite the later, it's okay. But some total shift means total charge conservation. And if you break total charge conservation, all the shifts can be broken. So this shift field corresponds to the quasi particle number on each branch.
Okay, that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Almost, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I understand what he's saying.
Yeah, I think that, right, so yeah, that's probably true. So if you want to conserve charge in each mode, then you're allowed to have that shift symmetry, but then you're not allowed to write down tunneling terms. And so by saying that we want to physically allow tunneling, then we're breaking the symmetry. Okay, that's pretty helpful. Okay, so this is an example that we can put our minds around that shows that we can simply write down gapping vectors that will give us two edge phases, which are obviously distinguished from each other. And I say obviously because we compute their scaling dimensions and they have a different minimum scaling dimension. And so now I can consider the two experiments that I mentioned before. So, yeah?
You draw like a phase diagram of the edge. So depending on the bare values of these two couplings, which gapping term would win? Is there any
So I haven't done this, but I have a thought on this, which is that I suspect that the phase diagram is 50% in each of these two phases because mathematically, it's just the change of variables as to which of them is more preferred. And actually, these backscattering operators that we're talking about, I'll say this again later, but you can change their relevance by changing the V matrix. Because these are non-chiral theories now, when we're introducing a backwards and a forwards moving mode, the scaling dimensions will depend on the V matrix. When we gap them out and it's all chiral, the scaling dimensions don't depend on the V matrix. So these types of terms, which need to have backscattering modes or backwards propagating modes, you can change, the V matrix will change their scaling dimensions. So you can make either one of them arbitrarily relevant if you had complete control over the V matrix. So I suspect if you made a phase diagram, it would be exactly split between the two phases. So I think the more important question to ask, which is a lot harder, is physically, which types of V matrices are most physical? You know, you want the strongest interactions between the nearest edge modes. And so if you were to incorporate this physical information, then that would give you a different phase diagram. Yeah, which it depends on which state you're starting with. I think whichever state you start with, it seems difficult to get into the other one physically because it requires very non-local interactions, but interactions between all of the edge modes. And physically, how are you going to get a term like that? But if you choose the right basis and you said, well, that's where I'm starting with physically, then you only need a backscattering term. Does that make sense? Yeah. Oh, cool. Sorry.
Vector in the beginning?
Mm-hmm. I chose it arbitrarily. So there's probably many of these ends, and half of them will go into this. And I don't know about half, but some will go here, and some will go to K1, and some will go to K2. And so you need to choose an end vector, re-diagonalize your theory, and it'll be block diagonal, and you need to see is the upper block K1 or K2.
So K2 is like a universal.
Okay. So
the K matrix that you get after you choose a specific end and then rotate it.
Okay. Yeah. So there's many ends you can choose, and you block diagonalize, and you see what's in the upper block, and it'll either be there's actually only two choices related by similarity transform. So you'll either get K1 or something that describes the same physics as K1. But maybe takes a different form. So that would be something related to K1 by similarity transform, or you'll get K2 or something related to K2. So you won't actually necessarily get either one of those, but if you looked at what you got, it would be related to one of those. And that's a statement of fact. There's only two possible choices. You could kind of see this by playing around with it.
Yeah, but it's could you prove there's only two, and in general, is it easy to find how many?
Yes, okay, so I'm going to get to this, actually. That's kind of the punchline. I was thinking maybe people would want a long introduction, but people are wanting to jump to the point. Yeah?
Do you need to have physical fraction greater than one?
So you don't, but you need to have more than one edge mode. So Laughlin states are no good because that's too simple. But if you could come up with, so most of the examples that we've come up with are greater than one, but you could come up, if you put bigger numbers here, like if we had K1 be like 3 and 5 or something, then we could, I think then we could do something. But all the examples that we've thought of are not. Yeah, so I think that there is an example for a bilayer system. I don't think you have to be greater than one, but the most obvious examples that come to mind are greater than one, because we usually just put one in one spot, put another number in the other spot. So in this example, we could do these two experiments. And as you would expect, we see two different scaling dimensions because they have different minimum scaling dimensions. And it's the minimum scaling dimension that will dominate the tunneling across either one of these types of quantum point contacts. Okay, so this is what I'm talking about now, more generally, is the notion of stable equivalence. So what we saw before is that we had K1 and K2, and they weren't related in this way. And we knew this because they have different scaling dimensions. So those describe distinct edges. But when we added sigma z to K1 and sigma z to K2, they were related. So now these enlarged phases, K1 plus sigma z and K2 plus sigma z, they are related. So they describe the same edge, which means that they can surround the same bulk. And since the addition of sigma z is topologically trivial, that means that K1 and K2 themselves surround the same bulk. And so this gives us this many-to-one relationship between different edges that can surround the same bulk. And so the word that we're using for this is stable equivalence. And there's other things that we could do besides adding sigma z. So we could add sigma x. And one reason you might want to do that is if you had a bosonic K-matrix, so a system made entirely of bosons, sigma z corresponds to a nu equals 1 strip, and all of a sudden nu equals 1 is not trivial when you have a system of bosons, because electron excitations are fractional if your underlying constituent particle is a boson. Another thing that you could do is adding several strips of nu equals one. And then another thing that you could do is just adding a block of anything that has determinant one. And so one question is also, are all these things the same? And I'll come back to this later, but the answer is that they are. And so, right, so this is a good point to make the distinction between phases of bosons and phases of fermions. So if you have a system who's entirely made of bosons, then the K-matrix only has even numbers on the diagonal. But if you have a system with fermions, then you can have odd numbers on the diagonal. So for a real system of bosons, you can't add sigma z. Like I said, that's non-trivial. But for a system of fermions, you could add sigma z or sigma x. And it's actually pretty easy to show that whenever you add sigma z, you can do a transformation to make it look like you added sigma x. So these two things are the same. And that partially answers the question on the previous page of are there different types of stable equivalents depending on what type of matrix you're adding.
So in these transformations,
mm-hmm.
the K odd is changed, right? They're different K odd. Not the sign of the equation.
But they're related K odds.
Yeah, related, but they don't have the same.
But difference. if they're related, then you could do a smaller W transformation and show that then it's the same K odd. So I think it's actually I think you can make them to be the same.
Okay.
It's actually not super difficult to do. Okay, so these are the questions that I'm going to answer in the rest of the talk. When can you have different distinct edge phases? How can you count them? How can you know how many you have? Are there different types of stable equivalents? And, well, I kind of already answered this, but when there's two different options, is one of them going to be preferred because the gapping term that leads to it is more relevant? So to answer these questions, we're going to do just a brief summary of the math that's involved. So for every K-matrix, we can make a lattice. And the way that we do this is, depending on the size of the K-matrix, so n by n matrix, we take n basis vectors, and we assign them an inner product so that the inner product of ei and ej is just the entry in the K-matrix, kij. So this defines an inner product on basis vectors, and so then we can take linear combinations with integer coefficients of these basis vectors, and that gives us a lattice. But we could always choose a new basis for this lattice. And if we choose a new basis, we certainly want, in this new basis, we need to include all the same points, and no extra points. And the condition for doing this is, of course, a W transformation. And so what we see that is that the old basis vectors and the new basis vectors is just taking us from k to k prime, and k prime are related by W transformation. So the point is that a lattice not only corresponds to a K-matrix, it corresponds to an equivalence class of K-matrices. So we can fairly say that edge phases are equivalence classes of K-matrices, which are lattices. And from the lattice, we can get out everything physical that we want. So the lengths of the lattice vectors are the scaling dimensions of the operators that are allowed on the edge. And the minimum scaling dimension is the minimum vector length for your lattice. Yeah?
The previous definition
of the
T-matrix, isn't that also important?
Right. So the T-matrix is important. And the thing that happens, in the previous example when I showed K1 and K2 being stably equivalent, if you had a T1, you have to have the right T2. So K1 and K2 are stably equivalent by some choice of W. And then T2 is going to have to be like W times T1. So you could, if you really want to think about charge conservation, I mean, you could say that K1 and T1 might describe a different theory than K2 and an arbitrary choice of T2. So it has to be like K1, T1, and then K2 and the proper choice of T2. So the lattices give you the stable equivalence of K matrices, but however you related them tells you how their T's must be related. Does that make sense? Yeah, so now if you want to ignore charge conservation, then you wouldn't have to worry about this. But usually you want charge conservation for quantum Hall systems. Okay, so from this lattice, we can get out all the physical stuff. We can get out the scaling dimensions, and the quasi-particles correspond to dual lattice vectors. And so you might ask, well, why do they correspond to dual lattice vectors instead of lattice vectors? But the point is that we know we want our quasi-particle statistics to have this k-inverse here, and the dual lattice has the inner product that's exactly k-inverse. So naturally, the dual lattice gives us the inner product that we want to give us the statistics for the quasi-particles. The lattice, because we're talking about integer k-matrices, the lattice is contained in the dual lattice. So actually, some of these quasi-particles are also on the original lattice, and these are exactly the trivial ones. They, if you put them in here, they have trivial statistics. Yeah, do you have a question?
So you're talking about the old system, Fermat system, or both. So in this equivalent class definition, what's the difference between both and Fermat in your
Chinese lattice? Oh, well, lattices that have...
The diagram is not there.
Lattices that have only even length vectors will be bosons. Does that make sense? Well, fermions will have odd length vectors.
Can you also describe a fermion in such kind of language?
In what kind of language?
In this equivalent class. So this equivalent class is also described fermion, or it's...
Yeah, it describes, if you have lattices and they have, say, like a length one vector, then it'll be a fermion system. So it describes bosons and fermions the same way.
Yeah, but I think there's ambiguity for the fermion because if you consider the T matrix, there's some plus minus one ambiguity. So how can I see this ambiguity from this setup?
Right. So, So actually, the tricky part is, I don't think the tricky part is comparing fermions to fermions. The tricky part is comparing fermion theories to boson theories. Because if you have a fermion theory, you're given a T matrix. And so then you can match.
Fermion theory, T is not a well defined. You can always attach trivial particles to change the sign.
Yeah. So one thing that we realized when we were doing this is that there's actually a choice of T that you kind of want in order to preserve this Gauss-Milgram sum. So if you choose the wrong, all choices of T, like you said, T squared is physical. Some choices of T, if you try to do this Gauss-Milgram sum, you would always add up ones and minus ones and you would get zero. But if you, there's a way to always choose the right choice of T, which gives you a Gauss-Milgram sum, which is meaningful, and it actually will give you the chiral central charge. And so that's the right choice of T for this work.
So what's the precise condition?
I actually wasn't really going to mention this, But the Gauss-Milgram sum is a sum over all quasi-particles, and it gives every quasi-particle a phase. And if you do this sum on the right-hand side, you get another phase, and that other phase tells you the central chiral central charge of the theory. And so this always holds for bosonic theories, but if you have a fermionic theory, because the phases, like you're saying, the phases are kind of defined ambiguously up to a minus one, you might add them all up wrong and get zero. But if you choose the right choice, then you get something meaningful on the right side. So there's a prescription for choosing the right choice. Maybe I can tell you this afterwards, actually, because we're almost done, and we've clearly figured this out. It's all written down nicely, and it's probably easier to look at that than for me to say it right now. Okay, so. Dual lattice gives us quasi-particles. The quasi-particles that lie on the original lattice are trivial. And so when we're talking about a bulk phase and all the quasi-particle species that it has infinitely many quasi-particles, but we want to mod out by the trivial quasi-particles. So in other words, like for Laughlin state, we want E over 3 quasi-particle and 4 E over 3 quasi-particle to be the same because they're related just by an electron. And so when we mod out by trivial stuff, we get a finite group, which we could call primitive quasi-particles. And so using... It's like the fusion rules.
Okay, so it's not abelian group.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's definitely going to be an abelian group for the stuff that we're considering. So using our lattice formulation, the way that we get this is by taking the dual lattice and just modding out by the lattice. So that's like taking the quasi-particles and dividing out by trivial quasi-particles. And so this is called the discriminant group. And we can see that different lattices might have the same discriminant groups because you're kind of modding out by the original lattice. And since lattices and edge phases correspond one-to-one and bulk phases have a discriminant group, this gives us a hint of how we're going to get this many-one relationship between edge phases and bulk phases. But it turns out that the discriminant group isn't the only right classification. So actually, the classification that we want to classify sets of lattices is it's a mathematical notion called a genus. And so I'll just define it here. So a genus of lattices is defined by the discriminant group, the inner product on lattice vectors, a signature, and the parity. So parity is evenness versus oddness, or bosons versus fermions. And if we look at how we define a bulk phase, it's defined by quasi-particle statistics, chiral central charge, and whether it's made of bosons or fermions. So we can see that there is a correspondence between these. Quasi-particle statistics is like the discriminant group gives us the quasi-particles, the inner product gives us their statistics. The signature gives us the chiral central charge. And the reverse arrow is only kind of true, but since we're talking about chiral stuff, this R minus is zero, and so then the chiral central charge and the signature are the same. And then parity and constituent quasi-particles are the same. So actually, this shows us that a genus determines a bulk phase, and a bulk phase determines a family of genuses. And the reason I say family is because there's this other subtlety that I don't really want to talk about, which is that chiral central charge, physically, people say is defined mod 24. But for the systems that we're talking about, if we're going to just limit ourselves to systems that have chiral central charge less than 24, then we can say that this genus and bulk phase relationship is one-to-one. So this means that we kind of nailed down the classification that we want, and then we can use this theorem by Nikulin, which says that lattices in the same genus are exactly lattices that are stably equivalent to each other, using the notion of stable equivalence on their inner product. But in physics language, this means that edge phases that surround the same bulk are exactly the edge phases that are stably equivalent. And in this mathematical paper, they go through and talk about all the different types of stable equivalence that I mentioned before, sigma x, sigma z, any matrix with determinant one. And they kind of did the super heavy lifting for us. So, okay, so that's kind of the nice result. Well, we've tried reading it. Yeah, so we made enough progress reading it that we could utilize it. So that's why there's a lot of authors on the paper. So this goes back to this is kind of then the next question you want to ask is, well, if you have this classification, how many lattices are in a particular genus? Or how many edge phases can describe a particular bulk phase? And the answer is in this Smith-Siegel-Minkowski mass formula. So that's the right-hand side. And this is something, again, that I don't want to talk about. It's pretty complicated, but one can look it up on Wikipedia. So again, the complication has been spared from us. It exists, and it's sitting there waiting for you. And on the left-hand side, this is a sum over all the lattices in the genus. So it's like summing over all the edge phases. And then this automorphism function is just counting the number of automorphisms of the lattice, which is like symmetries of the K-matrix. So the program that one might want to follow is if you think you have all your different edge phases, then you can compute this left-hand side. And then you compare it to the right-hand side. And if these things are the same, then you know you have all the edge phases. And if these things are different, then you forgot one of the edge phases. So this program doesn't give you the edge phase that you're missing, but it tells you whether you've completed your classification. And so this too has been done for us somewhat. So for chiral abelian quantum Hall states that have 10 or more edge modes, they always have different edge phases, more than one. If you have between 2 and 10 edge modes, a finite set of these bulk phases have only one edge phase, but the other infinitely many sets have multiple edge phases. So the result that we see here is that having many edge phases is actually the normal situation, not the exception. Purely chiral edge phases, right. So in general, you have more than one edge phase. That doesn't mean that physically realized quantum Hall states will, in general, have more than one edge phase.
So how does U equals 5 halves fit in your, is it?
It's not Abelian, so we're off the hook. Yeah, so I think that would be, so that's a really nice follow-up question. This series of statements is showing that if you have the same bulk, the same set of quasiparticles, then your edge is, you can have an edge phase transition. And so you might hypothesize that if you had different, you might hypothesize the same stuff for non-abelian states, except you can't formulate it using K matrices. So you might hypothesize that if you had different edge states that had the same bulk theory, that you could transition between them. Now that's different than like the many of the candidates now that are describing five halves describe different bulk phases. So that's a different situation.
I wonder if this neutral bulk can actually be important for the edge construction. Now you're sort of bringing new degrees of freedom, right? And they have charge zero, right? And then you have a neutral bulk in your body.
Yeah. I think incorporating anything that's not incorporated in K-mate, yeah, it's a really good question.
So what is that?
I don't have any intuition for it. I don't have any intuition for it.
So it's an integer. Some kind of invariant.
Well, I don't even know that it has to be integer because you're summing over one over integers, so I don't think it's integer.
I see. So something can be permanent.
Yeah, and is that like even looking? This is not a program I would carry out myself.
So this automorphism lambda is an integer, not?
Mm-hmm.
That's inside of the root value, it's an integer, right?
This thing is integer, but one over, you know, then it's one over integer. So I don't see any reason why the right hand side has to be integer.
Are you suggesting that the interaction role is short range?
So we're not really assuming that. So this V matrix gives us all the interactions between different edge modes, and that will, Coulomb will be in there, basically. Disorder will be in there, Coulomb will be in there. So this is exactly the problem. Physically, all these things are in there, but it's not obvious how to disentangle them.
If this long-range enough interactions, could something different happen?
So we're only considering things that are forming topological, you know, gapped phases that are quantum Hall states. So probably you could have sufficiently different interactions that you would get like a different bulk state, and then that's kind of outside of the realm of classification. Is that not okay? Let's talk after.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. This 10 is, if your K matrix is of size 10 by 10 or greater than that, and that's just the result that people find. I think people actually did this for sizes 2, 3, 4, you know, and between 2 and 10, they can find at least one example where you have only one edge mode, but above 10, I don't know this, I don't know how to prove this, but above 10, you always have more than one. So it's just, I don't think there's something special about the number. Okay, so then there's this point about even and odd K matrices. And so, like I said, adding sigma z to an even K matrix is kind of illegal unless you believe that your bosons are made of paired fermions. And so if you believe that you have a bosonic system, so it has an even K matrix, but the underlying particles are fermions, then you could ask something like, well, what if we bring down a nu equals one edge and it interacts and we can carry out this procedure between odd K matrices and even K matrices? And there are some other subtleties to this. So I just want to give two examples really quickly. So the first example is nu equals 8 integer quantum Hall state. So we think that this is really interesting just because it kind of seemed like integer quantum Hall, we had figured everything out. And so just to have this new little twist to the story gives us fractional quantum Hall people something new to play with. So the K matrix for integer quantum Hall nuke was 8 is just the identity matrix. But you can show that it's stably equivalent to this matrix, which we call KE8, which is a bosonic matrix. And this is just an algebraic exercise. And this describes a completely different edge phase. And so we could carry out the experiments that I described before. And if you're in the usual integer quantum Hall edge phase, current is always proportional to voltage. But in this different phase, which is bosons, you don't have an electron to tunnel across the quantum point contact. So you get current is proportional to V cubed. And I think another experiment you could do here is look at shot noise. So if you took the ratio of shot noise to tunneling current, in this first case, you would just get the number E, the electron charge. But in the second case, you would get 2E. So this might even be a more clear signature, because a lot of the shot noise experiments are easier to interpret than the scaling exponents. And similarly, you could also do this tunneling in from an a metallic lead, and you run into a problem because you can never, well, it's not a problem, it's this different scaling dimension because you don't have electrons to tunnel into the bosonic edge. And so this correspondence between odd and even edge phases is, there's also some mathematical statements relating this. And so this is actually just kind of interesting, and it's basically the last thing that I'll say. There's a theorem that says, paraphrasing it into the language of quantum Hall, for every fermionic bulk phase, there is a corresponding bosonic bulk phase. And the caveats are that this bosonic bulk phase might have a different number of edge modes, so same set of quasiparticles, but a different number of field Landau levels. And also, same quasiparticles is defined mod E. So I'll give an example which makes this clear. So consider Laughlin 1/5 state. This state has K matrix equals 5. There's nothing you can transform this into. But you could also consider nu equals 3 plus 1/5 state. And this has actually been observed by Jim Eisenstein. You can see a little plateau here. And so you might think 1/5, 3 plus 1/5, what kind of new physics can you get out of this? But actually, this 3 plus 1/5 state is stably equivalent to this bosonic lattice. And so I think this is a particularly interesting point, because you kind of think, well, 1/5 and 3 plus 1/5 are the same, but actually it seems like there's something else going on here. And so for any of the Laughlin states, you could always do this. You can always add a certain number of field Landau levels and get an even lattice that's kind of its partner. And so this actually comes back to your question, to know how many field Landau levels you need to add is exactly, this is related to the prescription of how you choose the T matrix. So this is all related stuff that I won't get into.
Excuse me.
They'll
say that these states, it's equivalent to the bosonic one.
Stable equivalent. Yeah.
She has to attach a sigma z.
Oh, but there's sigma z out there, I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But so physically in the edge, what does it mean?
You
pair up these electrons or like these fermionic
particles? Yeah, I think these bosonic things you can kind of think of as paired states. That's the only way to think of them. They don't have any single electron gapless operators, so that's kind of like superconducting state. It's kind of we just think of it as a paired state. You can write this as a hierarchy state of bosons.
The
way to think of it.
I think these two edges can be the edge of the same bulk, if the bulk is real as fermionic state.
Yeah. So it needs to be made of fermions underneath, or else you're doing something really highly non-trivial. So you can do this. And in terms of mapping the quasiparticles in the normal 3 plus 1/5 state, you would say that your quasiparticles have allowed charge that are multiples of 1/5. 1/5, 2/5, 3/5, 4/5. But in this paired state, you get multiples of 2/5. And so the mapping that preserves the statistics between them is modulo the electron. And so the 1/5 gets mapped to the 6/5 quasiparticle. 2/5 gets mapped to 2, but then 3/5 goes to 8/5. And so I just wanted to point out that there is this mapping, but it's modulo the electron, because you're assuming that you have underlying electron system. Oh, okay. So then,
that's true. Yeah. The angry dynamic theory can be equivalent, stable equivalent for the bosonic theory.
Right.
It is a general phenomenon.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's a general phenomenon. It's an always statement, but you need to fill a prescribed number of Landau levels.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, and then I guess I kind of answered this question already. Which gapping vector is most relevant? Well, because you're adding counterpropagating modes when you're putting in these backscattering terms, that means that scaling dimensions depend on the V matrix. And so if you had complete control over your V matrix, you could make any term you wanted relevant. So the question of could a particular gapping term be relevant? Well, yes, if I had complete control over the V matrix, I could make it relevant. Unfortunately, people who are doing experiments don't have the control that I have. And even if I told them, oh, this is the V matrix that I want, it's not even clear what that means experimentally, because interactions between edge modes, that's not a tunable quantity. So there's still a pretty big gap in things that we want and how to express them in terms of experimental quantities that people can tune. Okay, so these are conclusions, but maybe more interesting than conclusions are our next steps. So maybe I'll just leave this up here. Obviously, the major next step is how could we tune between edge phases physically? We could certainly ask an experimentalist, hey, can you go to nu equals 8 integer quantum Hall state, do the experiments that we mentioned, and make some measurements. And that would tell us which of the edge phases that we're in, but that's not nearly as interesting as if we could say, hey, here's how you tune between edge phases, do the experiment, tune, do the experiment again. And I think that would obviously validate the theory in a lot more interesting way. The other direction is generalizing this classification to either non-chiral edge phases or non-abelian states. And then the other thing that I've been thinking about recently is this concept with entanglement entropy. If you could, people kind of think of making entanglement cut, the cut that you'll get corresponds to the edge you would have on the system. But if there's multiple possible edges, then which of these edges would you pick out? So yeah, these are thoughts that if you have ideas, I'd love to talk about them.
There's already been a lot of questions. Maybe we could put one or
two questions. Some questions.
No, the first one is
the paper says USSR. Can you read Russian actually?
No, it's in English. There's an English version. That's how you know it's written in Russian. There's an English version. I just wrote that citation.
Okay,
yeah.
Second one, serious. So you have this classification genus contain this discriminant group, and probably also some inner product for the basis structure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think your claim is that the genus may correspond to one to a unique bulk phase.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of feel like maybe the different genus may still correspond to the same bulk phase.
Different, you could consider, so there'll be a different genus for every size lattice. So so like 1/5, 1 + 1/5, 2 + 1/5, those are all assigned different genus, but we might say that those have the same bulk. So, okay, but is that what you're asking? I'm not sure.
I just say what point of view may not be always true, because, there are two things. One is that if I consider large K-matrices, usually we need to compare this S&T matrix,
mm-hmm.
and also include probably some relabeling for the quasi-particles.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's the case. The latest structure may be the same, or maybe the discriminant group can be the same, but I think that their statistics, I'm saying the opposite, actually the statistics will be the same, but the discriminant group can be the same.
Discriminant group and inner product, though. So inner product is K-matrix, which is the statistic. So statistics are incorporated in this. So it's basically like if you have the same S-matrix, or for fermions, I think same S and T, then I think you're good to go. I think the genus separates bosons and fermions, and so you kind of need a separate statement if you're comparing bosons and fermions, which we have, but then you have to expand the size of things. But as long as you're saying bosons to bosons and fermions to fermions, the genus is meant to be complete classification of, yeah, of quasiparticle species, but also their statistics.
There's also another reason, is because I think Bailoff and Moore, they have a paper, and then I think in the version of this discriminant group, I think it's more like a classical case, classical ratings, but they have a more, you know, kind of a new, it's a common kind of version for these ratings. I think they can identify further more ways than discriminant group. There's a paper by Moore.
Yeah.
So that's why I feel maybe, I don't know why these mathematical statements always.
Yeah, I don't think it goes any further than that. I don't think so. Because I think, yeah, I think statistics are kind of all you've got, as long as the mapping is one-to-one.
All right, let's thank you again.